It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear from a former UW-Madison men's basketball player who says it's time to start paying college athletes. First, it's time for a weekly look at national politics. After a House vote today, the Republican tax bill is headed to President Trump's desk. Also, the president's lawyers have accused Robert Mueller's investigators of improperly obtaining emails related to the ongoing Russia investigation. And new reports shed light on how the Treasury Department has been paying to settle sexual harassment cases. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you happy to see the Republican tax plan make it through Congress? Are you worried about the possible impact? How do you think it's going to play out politically for Republicans in the year ahead? And what do you think about allegations of bias in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Callum Borchers joins us now. He covers the intersection of politics and the media for The Fix at The Washington Post. Callum, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be with you.
Well, the big news today is the passage of the Republican tax overhaul bill. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan after the Senate had approved the plan last night.
We said in 2016 that it would take real tax reform for families and businesses to get the American economy growing, and we were serious. And the American people placed their trust in us to do this work for them. And today, we're making good on that promise.
So, Callum, a victory lap for Republicans this afternoon?
No question. This is the biggest legislative accomplishment of the Trump presidency by a long shot. It did sort of have to clear an extra hurdle today after a hiccup last night in which, of course, the House and Senate have to pass identical bills. And House held up its end of the bargain, and then the Senate said, oh, hold on a sec. We got to make a couple of tweaks at the end here to follow the Byrd rule. So they did that. They re-voted in the House today, and here we are. And Republicans are right to feel like they have really accomplished something here. I think the question, though, is, you know, sort of how it will be received by the public. You know, congressional Republicans have been marketing this first and foremost as a middle class tax cut. And it is that, at least up front. But of course, most of the benefits are actually weighted toward the upper class and toward corporations. And in fact, the president in his cabinet meeting said today that the corporate tax cut was actually the biggest factor in the bill. So there has been some mixed messaging, you might say.
And this has not been popular in public opinion polls. When people are asked, more people dislike it and distrust this tax plan than like it. Republicans are saying, hey, you're going to see most of you are going to see some kind of tax cut starting right away next year. What are people watching for with the reception of this bill now that it's going to be passed?
Well, for your listeners who saw some of the celebration at the White House maybe an hour or so ago, Republicans were very explicit in what they want their voters to do. They said, start looking at your paycheck in February. That's when you should see an increase. And, of course, that's in line with what Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, said yesterday at a news conference when he was asked about why the bill polls so poorly. And he said, well, look, my feeling is that folks are going to learn to love this bill down the line when they start seeing more money to take home in their paychecks. Now, that may well be the case, but, you know, there's also going to perhaps be some looking askance at, well, what's the guy or the gal who makes more than I taking home? Because I think that what the Republicans are sort of glossing over here is that it's not just that the top earners are taking home more in raw dollar amounts. You would sort of expect that to be the case, right? Because if, you know, if everybody across the board got, say, a 2.2% increase in after-tax income, which is what the average is, according to the Tax Policy Center, well, then obviously the top earners would get more raw dollars out of that, right? I mean, 2% of a larger amount is more than 2% of a smaller amount. That's basic math. But the percentages are also skewed. The Tax Policy Center said that if you're in the lowest fifth of earners in this country, your additional take-home pay is only going to be 0.4%. Now, that's better than nothing, but it's not 2.2%. And if you go to the top earners, the top fifth, well, they're going to take home an extra 2.9%. So it's not just an imbalance in the raw dollar amount. It's also a larger percentage for the top earners as well.
Talking to Callum Borchers from The Washington Post, looking at the big news in national politics, the biggest news right now, the tax plan passed by Congress. I want to bring on a caller now. Tim is on the line in Shell Lake. Tim, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think the tax cut's a good thing, especially the corporate tax cut. It's been proven many times, beginning with John Kennedy's administration, the Reagan tax cut. The economy grows when there's a tax cut, and when the economy grows, it brings more money to the federal government in the form of revenue.
Tim, thanks for the call. We've had economists on the show arguing for and against that point of view, Tim, as far as the supply side economics there. But Tim's definitely in line with what Republicans are selling here, right, Callum?
Well, that's right. I think, though, the question is sort of how much can the economic growth offset the cost of this bill, right? So remember, Republicans went through sort of a special budgeting process here called reconciliation. It's pretty wonky, but it essentially meant that they could pass this with a simple majority. But they had to stay within certain spending constraints. And so what they authorized here was an increase to the federal debt of up to $1 trillion. Now, they have said, of course, that it's not actually going to cost that much money, that we're going to sort of grow the economy, and it's going to offset those expenses, but it's hard to make up the full amount. And if you look at what the nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation estimated, they said, well, you know, maybe a third of that will be compensated for by growth, but you're still going to add about $1 trillion to the debt over the next decade. And so perhaps that's worthwhile. It should goose the economy a little bit, but there is a cost to it as well.
Want to check out the Affordable Care Act angle here. President Trump talked about that a little bit at a White House press conference this afternoon, taking out the individual mandate in this plan.
I hate to say this, but we essentially repealed Obamacare because we got rid of the individual mandate, which was terrible. And that was a primary source of funding of Obamacare.
So Affordable Care Act, I mean, this is something that may have a lot of consequences that we may not know at this point, right, Callum?
Yeah, there's a ripple effect here, and I'm very curious to watch how this is received as well, you know, because recall that when Republicans tried multiple times this year to repeal Obamacare in a more straightforward sense, they got a lot of criticism even from folks on the right, from Breitbart News of all places, which, of course, was one of the president's biggest cheerleaders during the campaign, and the critique was, you're not following through with a clean, full repeal of Obamacare. You're just sort of stripping away one part of it. And so that's really what we're doing here in this tax bill as well. The president is touting the repeal of the individual mandate. That is one big component of the Affordable Care Act for sure. But you certainly couldn't characterize this as a full repeal. And so I just wonder whether the president's base will sort of score this one as a promise kept. Will that be good enough for them, or will they say, well, hold on, this isn't quite what you promised on the campaign trail?
Want to bring on another caller now. Thanks to Tim for his call. Sharon is with us now in Milwaukee. Sharon, hi.
Hi. My question is, with this tax cut, what does it do for the people that make like $40,000 to $70,000 a year? If I understand right, they're taking away tax deductions, and I don't have kids, so that child credit doesn't make a difference. Mine are all grown. How does it help the average working person?
Sharon, thanks for the call. Callum, I don't know if you have all the details for each range, but what do we know about people in that 40 to 70-ish thousand zone?
Yeah, so they would sort of probably fall between that first and second quintile of income earnings. And so the average after-tax income increase for those folks is between 0.4% and 1.2%. So you're going to see some. But again, those are averages. And I think without consulting your sort of individual tax advisor, you'd have to figure out, well, you know, how much of that is based on a credit like the child tax credit that your caller said says she would not be eligible for. And also keep in mind that some of this is location-based. So, you know, the estimate right now from the Tax Policy Center is that about 95% of the country is going to see some amount of tax savings. Well, the other 5%, though, that you're talking about folks in places like New York and New Jersey and California, where you know, you might get hit by the new cap on how much state and local income tax you can deduct, which is $10,000 now. So there may be folks who, yes, they're seeing a dip in their federal tax rate, but they're not able to write off as much of their state income taxes as they were in the past. And so in the net, they see a tax increase. So as with all of these things, it is specific to every individual case. But generally speaking, at least for 2018, the vast majority of taxpayers are going to see at least some reduction.
Sharon, thanks for that call. Before we move on to other issues, Callum, I want to get back to the politics here. Paul Ryan has said, basically, we're ready to run on this in 2018. When asked, he wasn't clear on whether he personally would be running on this in 2018, which is a whole other question. And meanwhile, a poll came out, this is released today, on ballots. Generic Democrat beats generic Republican congressional races something like 16%, which is a huge margin. So the politics of this in 2018, what do you think?
Well, you can see that the Republicans were eyeing 2018 just in the way they structured this bill, right? Because a lot of the benefits, at least for middle-class voters, are front-loaded in this bill. So partly because of the budget process they went through, that reconciliation that we mentioned a moment ago that required them to stay within certain budget constraints, what Republicans did was they built in an expiration date for these tax cuts. So many of the individual tax cuts will sunset, will go away after 2025. Now, Paul Ryan said yesterday and reiterated again today that Congress, he expects, would reauthorize those tax cuts when it comes up. But of course, that's not a sure thing. And as a result, you've had the estimate from the Tax Policy Center that by 2027, a slight majority of taxpayers will actually see a tax increase because of the deductions going away. And so I think the question for 2018 becomes, how are voters looking at this? Are they looking at it just in the short term? Are they going to start looking at those paychecks in February, as Republicans are asking them to do, and say, hey, you know, I do notice a few extra bucks in my paycheck. I'm really happy about that, and I'm more inclined to vote Republican because of it. Or will they sort of have in the back of their minds, but I know this is temporary, and what I've been told is that in the long run, my taxes are actually going to go up, and I'm not happy about it.
Callum Borchers is with us from the Washington Post. It's our weekly roundup of the top news in national politics. We're going to move on to some other issues coming up in just a couple minutes, including the latest on the Mueller investigation, a challenge in how they got some campaign transition emails from the Trump transition team. What do you think about that, about where the investigation is now? You can join us at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Plus some UFOs. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our talk with Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the biggest political stories of the week. It wasn't all taxes this week, Callum. We saw this challenge from some of President Trump's legal team, I believe, to the Mueller investigation, talking about how they got a whole cache of emails related to the transition. What's going on there?
Right. So just to set this up, we're talking about emails that were exchanged among Trump officials between Election Day and Inauguration Day. And the argument from the Trump team is, look, those should be private property. We weren't government employees yet. We were the incoming administration. And Mueller's team shouldn't have been able to get its hands on it. Of course, Mueller's team got the emails through the General Services Administration. And the Trump team's accusation is that this is basically another example of the deep state that is out to get them. They allege that career workers at the GSA handed over these emails to Mueller's team when they should not have. This is something that is a little bit foggy, because typically this doesn't become an issue. Most of the time there wouldn't be a special prosecutor looking or asking for these transition emails in the first place, so there wouldn't really be any clear answer as to whether it's appropriate to turn them over or not. And there are conflicting opinions on this. It would seem that perhaps one of the key distinctions could be which accounts Trump officials were using at the time. One of my colleagues at the Post talked to Randall Eliason, who's a former federal prosecutor. He now teaches at George Washington Law School. But the way he put it was that, if you're not using your personal email and you were using a .gov email, which some of these officials might have been doing even before they were sworn in, he would say, look, you can't have any expectation of privacy. Whether you're on the government payroll yet or not, that's a public record. and it should be turned over. So what you might have is a situation where you're parsing, well, which emails were sent and received from .gov accounts, and others might have been coming from, you know, Trump.org accounts or something like that.
Let's bring on a caller. Nate is with us in Milwaukee. Nate, hi.
Hi, thank you. I thought there was an interesting editorial about the Mueller investigation written by Joel McNally recently, and he actually said that Republicans practiced some of the tactics they're trying out with the Mueller investigation on the John Doe investigation, where in both situations, one with Donald Trump, the other with Scott Walker, you had notable Republicans being investigated for something that seemed improper, and they came out with claims of partisanship. I mean, recently the texts have been used as an example against Mueller, where it was actually Republican partisans claiming partisanship on behalf of either independent investigators or investigators that were made up of bipartisan groups of people where you actually had Republicans and Democrats working together on the investigation.
Nate, thanks for the call, Cal, and that John Doe story is unique here to Wisconsin. But on a national level, there have been a lot of attacks on the integrity of the Mueller investigation.
No question. I'm not familiar with the specific editorial your caller is referencing, but he's certainly right that we are seeing familiar tactics here. Something I wrote about this week was the sort of familiarity of the attacks on Mueller if you look back to attacks that were lodged against Kenneth Starr, of course, who was the special counsel in the Whitewater investigation of Bill Clinton, you know, 20-plus years ago. And you see sort of the same arguments, you know, well, this is partisan. You know, in the case of Kenneth Starr, he was a Republican himself, and so of course some Democrats in the administration complained, well, he's from the opposition party. Kenneth Starr had considered a Senate run as a Republican. He'd been the Solicitor General under George H.W. Bush, and of course Clinton had defeated Bush, so the accusation was that maybe there is some sour grapes there and he's grinding an axe. I mean, these are the kinds of charges that you get. Mueller's a little bit different, right, because he's actually a registered Republican himself, just like Trump, but he has hired some attorneys on his team who are Democratic donors, and of course you've got the one FBI agent whose text messages have spilled into the open in the past week or so, in which he was exchanging anti-Trump sentiments with an FBI lawyer. So all of these things have sort of fueled a very familiar fire that allows, you know, whoever is under investigation by a special counsel to call into question the integrity of the probe.
Nate, thanks for that call. We're talking to Callum Borchers from the Washington Post, looking at the big stories in national politics this week. Want to check out the latest on sexual harassment issues in Congress. Some payouts from the Treasury Department. Some cases we know where they were going, and some cases we don't. What's the latest?
That's right. We're sort of slowly getting to more information on this, but we still sort of have a long way to go as well. So the Treasury Department says that it paid out something like $175,000over a few years, stemming from, I believe, it's 15 cases within the House, but we still don't have really much of a look into how the Senate has been handling its business. We also wouldn't know necessarily if members of Congress were settling complaints against them using their own funds. You know, this is just sort of whatever public dollars have been spent on the case. And of course, sort of the broader issue, which is sort of now under review in Congress, is, you know, what are the standards in place as far as confidentiality and disclosure? I think that most members of Congress agree at this point that if the victim or alleged victim in a case wants to remain private, that's one thing. But there are many cases in which they would like to speak out, but are prevented from doing so because they have been required to sign confidentiality agreements in order to obtain, in some cases, relatively small settlements.
And then a quick look at a couple other stories. Trump nominee for the Import-Export Bank was rejected. Scott Garrett was the nominee. A couple Republicans on a panel, on a committee, switched over and voted against him, I guess along the lines that he had talked previously about wanting to get rid of the Import-Export Bank.
Right. And one of those Republicans who switched over was Tim Scott of South Carolina, whom the president was praising effusively today at the tax bill celebration. So apparently he's not holding a grudge there. But you're right. That seemed to be the real hang-up for these Republicans was, hey, Scott Garrett, when you were in Congress, you voted twice against reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank. That's, by the way, not a fringe position. There are plenty of Republicans who also don't like that institution. But you'd figure that if you're going to head the Ex-Im Bank, then you maybe ought to actually be a fan of the organization that you're going to lead, and I think that was kind of the chief objection.
And finally, a quick look. Recently released information showing a Department of Defense research and investigation into unidentified flying objects. What has come out here?
Yeah, this is interesting stuff. To me, the most interesting so far has been some of the footage. You know, you've had a Navy fighter pilot sort of describing what he believes is his encounter in the sky with a UFO. And the thing that has also stood out to me is when you've heard the former director of this program in interviews, he has talked about really just sort of the focus, the really sober focus, I guess you could say, on national security. You know, he said, look, frankly, I don't know whether some of these apparent aircraft that we've seen in the sky come from China or Russia or Mars or your dog next door. And to some degree, I don't care. My job is to figure out whether it is a threat to our national security. That's the most important thing. And so what's sort of striking is this kind of two ways to look at it, which is that it fuels the conspiracy theories that are sort of fun to kick around. And then on the other hand, you see these sort of very serious sounding people within the government who have been leading this program sort of not really worrying too much about whether it comes from outer space or not and really just trying to think about how do we keep the country safe.
Once upon a time, this might have been a slow news week and we would have spent a lot more time looking at this UFO investigation. There's just too much going on now, huh?
There is. I suppose it's a good problem to have as we get toward the end of the year, because sometimes we sort of are limping to the finish line in a given year, but not this time around. There is plenty to talk about.
Callum, thanks a lot for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
That's Callum Borchers. He covers the intersection of media and politics for The Fix at The Washington Post. He was with us for a weekly recap of national news. First, the American marten was completely wiped out in Wisconsin during the early 20th century. The state began a program to bring back the weasel-like animal in the 1950s. State conservation workers reintroduced a handful of the animals on the Apostle Islands of Lake Superior. As Danielle Kading reports, that attempt was believed to be a failure until several years ago.
All right, you're good to exit, gentlemen and ladies.
Ken Pemble drops off Northland College students on Hermit Island. It's one of several islands where they'll check camera traps with the hopes they've captured shots of the American marten. The Apostle Islands resource technician says visitors first spotted martens several years ago.
In 2010, this photo was taken, and it was just said, well, that's a fisher. Nobody expected there to be martens, so you're not looking for them. 2015, we look at that photograph again, and it was definitely a marten.
Now students and researchers at Northland College and UW-Madison are working with the National Park Service and state and tribal agencies to study the small mammal that's endangered in Wisconsin. Northland College professor Eric Olson says they're working to solve a bit of a mystery.
We just coincidentally had a carnivore project going on Stockton Island that then documented them on Stockton Island. That led to a whole bunch of questions. Where are they in the islands? Where did they come from? And what's the relative abundance across these islands?
Those are important questions for people who want the species to thrive. The marten is culturally significant to Ojibwe tribes, and they're a sign of a healthy forest ecosystem. The animal's success could also have economic benefits. In other states, martens are trapped for their fur. So far, Olson and his students have found martens on at least 7 of the Apostle Islands. They've been maintaining camera traps and collecting scat in the park to see how far their reach extends. Walking through thick underbrush on Otter Island, Olson spies something on a downed log.
That's what you're looking for right there. Likely an American marten scat.
It's hard to spot because it's only about as wide as a pencil eraser and maybe an inch long.
There's kind of a signature you're looking for, and often you can kind of look for a spot that has a lot of downed logs and look near the downed logs.
The islands are full of downed trees and thick shrubs, making it a difficult hike. But Olson says that's just the kind of habitat where martens thrive, and it may be one reason why they're seeing them on the Apostle Islands.
It's kind of wild to think about the fact that there may be a decent-sized population out in this Apostle Islands area, and how they're related with the mainland martin is that big question, and what their origins are.
Researchers can use DNA from scat and hair samples to pinpoint just that. This fall, researchers began a four-year project to find out whether martins on the Apostle Islands are relatives of those that were introduced back in the 50s. UW-Madison Assistant Forestry Professor John Pauley says it's also possible the animals came from a group of martins that were reintroduced into northern Wisconsin's Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest.
We have this place now that cryptically, sometime from somewhere, has been populated, been colonized, and trying to understand when and how that happened and where this population is going and whether the trajectory of this population is any different than the Shawamigan and the Nicolet.
Pauley says studies in the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest show martin numbers are small and at risk of disappearing. He says learning more about martins in the Apostle Islands could reveal a lot about recovery efforts in Wisconsin.
It's a really important and interesting comparison. If we can maybe understand why the martin on the Apostle Islands have what appears to have grown and be doing apparently okay, what the differences then are from that system to these other places where growth hasn't been nearly as sharp.
Pauley says that may show them what could be done on the mainland to support a thriving martin population in Wisconsin. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, college athletics is a big business for many universities, often bringing in millions of dollars of revenue annually from ticket sales, merchandising, television contracts, and product endorsements. But the athletes don't get paid, and that's been a growing controversy. It was recently reported that former UW-Madison basketball star Nigel Hayes attempted to organize a boycott of a nationally televised game against Syracuse in 2016. All the players weren't on board, so that boycott never happened. But the subject of paying college athletes remains a hotly debated issue. Zach Bohannon was the captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. He's a supporter of the idea of paying college athletes. Zach, welcome to Central Time.
I appreciate you having me on the show.
And I understand, Zach, that you know when you came to college, came to the team, you didn't like this idea of paying college athletes. What changed your mind?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's a great question. So back in 2011, I was a transfer from the United States Air Force Academy, and I kind of got a glimpse into the eyes of the mid-major type NCAA division of college athletics because I played basketball at the academy. And then I came to Wisconsin, and I was actually in a debate class at Communications 262, actually, at UW-Madison. And I took the side, like any typical fan, that I didn't agree with paying college athletes. They didn't need to get paid for a plethora of obvious reasons. And the more and more I started to debate it, I had to go against the other side. And I started to think with my economics cap on, since I was an economics major, and I started to think that, you know what, this makes no sense. The NCAA is an illegal cartel colluding to not let athletes make their fair share on the free market enterprise system. And so that's ultimately what changed my opinion at that time.
And can you talk about the kind of revenue that's involved in Division I college athletics, the big sports, the football and the basketball in particular?
Absolutely. And the biggest number right now that comes to mind is I just saw a statistic the other day that the athletes, which less than 5%, I think it's like 2 or 3% of them, end up making it to the NFL or NBA and making a chunk of their fair market value at the professionalized sports world. But the NCAA is big business in and of itself. Rivals actually the NFL and billions of dollars generated. It actually generates $13 billion annually by college football and college basketball, which is just incredible.
And as we mentioned Nigel Hayes earlier, can you talk about the kind of activism that you and he did and have done on this issue?
Absolutely. So when I was a junior at Wisconsin, I got one of my teammates was. I don't know how he got involved in it, but he got an email, a monthly email from the National Collegiate Players Association, the NCPA, which was led by a union activist, Ramogi Huma, who actually was a former UCLA football player back in the 90s. and he got this group of players together who just kind of stayed progressively active in what was going on with the NCAA and some of the things that took place. And Jared Bergeron ended up getting me involved and told me, hey, Zach, you should apply, or you should get on this email distribution list and end up finding a way to reach out to Romogi. So I ended up reaching out to him. I got on the weekly conference call with some of the other major college football players across the country, and that was kind of what fomented and led to the Northwestern unionization and some of the other things that took place, which ultimately what led me to getting Nigel involved in the lawsuit that he's in.
And yeah, you mentioned that lawsuit. It's not the first, but there have been efforts to unionize at one school and now class action lawsuits. So what are those lawsuits doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first lawsuit, which everyone, it kind of became the known lawsuit across the country, was the Ed O'Bannon lawsuit. Was quite frankly, Ed O'Bannon was a national player of the year, a basketball player at UCLA back in the late 90s. And he saw his son. He came home from work one day and saw his son playing a basketball game. He's like, hey, look, Dad, you're on this video game. And he literally ended up deciding, like, how is that possible that the NCAA can still use his name, image, and likeness without him profiting off of it and not get paid anything in return? So he ultimately sued the NCAA, and that became the name, image, and likeness based on the NCAA saying that they're colluding to not let them use that, which it kind of was a toss-up verdict in the end. It ruled in favor of O'Bannon, but it didn't necessarily make the necessary wholesale changes going forward. The next lawsuit that Romogi Huma had was Jeffrey Kessler, who's a world-renowned antitrust lawyer who actually brought free agency to the NFL, sued the NCAA in regards to saying that it was an antitrust case, that the schools are colluding with one another, in addition with the NCAA, to not let the students make their fair market value. So that's what ultimately Nigel got involved with.
And Zach, in an ideal world, if college athletes got paid, how do you see that working?
For sure. So this is a really touchy subject, and it's hard to get this across, this point of view across a lot of people. And I still don't necessarily, and this is where the straw man article that the NCAA just throws out there, I go, we're not for pay for play. Well, I'm not necessarily for pay for play either. I don't think college athletes should get paid. They should get paid based on their market rate, and they should be able to use their name, image, and likeness to go off and go sign autographs for, or go get their own endorsement deal. At the end of the day, if you're on scholarship as an English major and you write a best-selling novel that sells on Amazon, the English major can make money and profit off of that. If you're a world-renowned engineer who makes a patent, who's on a full-ride scholarship, you can still make money off a patent that you make based on your hidden talent or hidden skill that you have. Why should that be any different, and why should it be capped for college athletes just because they're on scholarship and say that that's their fair rate? It's not their fair rate. You see it all the way down the line where all this, like I said, the $13 billion of cash is just getting redistributed to the college coaches, the TV networks, the apparel companies, the schools, the conferences, everyone but the people who is actually doing the real labor.
I want to listen to Nigel Hayes earlier this year on ESPN's Dan Patrick Show. This is from back in March.
Okay, but what do you do if I gave you the opportunity to, you're running the NCAA, you draw it up?
I think it's best to be remove the not paying athletes, and I think you should be allowed the universities to compensate their athletes how they feel, especially the coaches. I know coaches and athletic directors, they agree that players should be paid. They don't say it publicly because they want to avoid the criticism that, you know, I'm receiving for saying this, but I think that they would definitely give the players more because they know some of the things the players have to go to. It's not necessarily agreed that the players want money. It's when they want to do something that they're unable to do. So, for instance, I wanted to see my mother for Thanksgiving freshman year, but I couldn't get home. I couldn't afford a plane ticket.
And that's a story we hear a lot. Players not being able to afford food, not being able, as you heard there, to fly home to see mom on a holiday. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about, Zach?
Absolutely. And you see this all at all different schools. It's not just at Wisconsin, and it's even more pronounced at other schools that don't come from as many as fortunate backgrounds and environments that some of us have at Wisconsin. But it's just it's literally a summation of everything the NCAA stands for. They have millions of these teenagers who accept scholarships to chase their dream of fame and fortune at the price of absolute submission to the whims of an organization, the NCAA, that puts their interests dead last. And that's what Nigel just highlighted, is that it's time for the NCAA to truly open up their eyes. And in me and Nigel's ideal world, it's most likely means that the NCAA needs to be blown up totally because the NCAA has placed the commercial success above its responsibilities of protecting the academic integrity, health, and well-being of the college athlete, and it's not going to change anytime soon with the NCAA in charge.
We're talking about the issue of compensating college athletes with Zach Bohannon, captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. What do you think? Should college athletes be compensated for playing sports? Should they be able to get endorsements on their own outside of the university? How should it work? Or is a college scholarship enough of a payment for student athletes? Share your thoughts on Twitter at CentralTimeWPR or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation now with Zach Bohannon, captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team, looking at whether college athletes should be compensated for their contributions to the lucrative business of college sports. How about you? Do you think college athletes should be paid or allowed to get outside endorsements? Why? How would it work? Do you agree with Zach's argument that it's the same as a different student writing a book, say, or getting a patent? Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. To your calls now. Jeremy is on the line at Ashland. Jeremy, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Absolutely not. College students should not get paid to play the sport. And for one, it is a sport. They don't have to play the sport to go to school. Plus, they're, you know, 99% of them are already getting the college scholarships, so they're already getting school for free, so the sport is just a bonus. And on top of it all, you know, you got some of these great big high schools down in the southern part of the country, and even, you know, some up here in the north. If you're going to pay college students, you might as well pay high school students too. Where does it end?
Jeremy, thanks for the call. A lot of the arguments against that you heard there, Zach, including, hey, there's scholarships, you're getting some real value out of this.
Absolutely, and it's a common argument. It's, like I said, a straw man article at the end of the day. I appreciate Jeremy's response to our conversation, but at the end of the day, are you going to limit the compensation that is available for any student who's on scholarship, who has a hidden talent that they've worked their entire life for, or a skill set that they've created on the free market that they're not able to be taken advantage of? So you're saying, like I mentioned in my previous argument, that a college writer who's a college student who's on an English major, he can't profit, or she can't profit off of a best-selling novel that they write, or an engineering student is not allowed to go make money off a patent he makes? Then you got to make it all across the board. So I disagree with the premise of his basic response.
Jeremy, thanks for the call. Go next to Jim in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I think there was a time in the 50s, the 60s, maybe even to the 70s, when college sports weren't the multi-million, almost billion-dollar industry that it is. I think a percentage of the profits that go to the sport should be set aside for the players. Particularly violent sports such as football, where we now know that concussion syndrome can lead to permanent, you know, harm and damage that students are not aware. Another thing that the last caller should understand is, for example, the professor of engineering doesn't make, you know, the chairman of the engineering department doesn't make multi-millions of dollars that the football coach does, and often the basketball coach does. This disparity between what the students are getting, the student athletes, and the coaches, in comparison even to the university president, shows a gross economic disparity and an inequality that should be addressed. And I'm not saying I have the best formula, but I think it's something that should be looked at. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for that call. And Zach, a related issue, people have pointed, a lot of these players, especially the low-income players coming to schools, are black. A lot of the coaches making six, seven-figure salaries are white. There's a racial division here, too.
Absolutely, and that's one of the biggest things that people don't like to look at. And Jim made a great point. A couple of them that I want to get into in a second, but you just made a great point in regards to the racial disparity. Taylor Branch, who's a civil rights historian who wrote some extensive research on the civil rights era, and I believe won a Pulitzer Prize of his writing, he wrote a piece called The Shame of College Sports in the Atlantic back in 2011, talking about the college sports scandal that's being taken place right now. And he talked about that the college sports has a whiff of the plantation. And Nigel Hayes has been outspoken about this as well. There's this big disparity between who's doing the majority of the labor. Up to 70% of college football and college basketball players are African-American, with the owners, per se, the coaches, the athletic directors, everyone else, the vast majority being white. And you're seeing this big pay discrepancy between the two,
And Taylor Brandt was the one who initially came out and said, talked about that dichotomy. With that said, going back to Jim's question, talking about the engineering professors and deans and whatnot, he makes a phenomenal point in regards to that, that why should the coaches have this insane salary, or athletic directors have these insane salaries compared to these professors or deans who are getting their salaries cut because of budget cuts within the school? And where exactly is all that money coming from? Quite frankly, the coach's base salary is in line with some of the professors and deans and whatnot at the university. But their money, the majority of it, and you saw with the recent scandal with Louisville's Rick Pitino, is Louisville actually gave upwards of 90% of the endorsement deal from Adidas to Rick Pitino's $7 million yearly salary. So $5.5 to $6 million is coming directly from the endorsement deal of the school, or of the school's marketing budget for Adidas, Nike, Under Armour, or so forth. One last point I want to make on that is that Bryce Jordan, the former Penn State president emeritus, asked Sonny Vaccaro back in the early 2000s, why should a university be an advertising medium for your industry? And that's where ultimately the money's coming from. And Sonny Vaccaro said, they shouldn't, sir. Your soul, you sold your souls, and you're going to continue selling them. You can be very moral and righteous in asking me that question, but there's not one of you in this room that's going to turn down any of our money. You're going to take it, and I can only offer it to you. So these endorsement deals are only being offered, and the schools know that they're making up money for some of the lost revenue that they're making. So, Jim, very well done and great point.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're talking to Zach Bohannon, former captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team, about paying athletes in sports. Zach, with this endorsement idea, one worry might be, okay, you've got a handful of marquee players, and they're making a ton of money. And then you've got everybody else, and you know, maybe they get a local car dealership or something. I don't know. Is this going to create this huge imbalance among players?
Look, there's already a huge imbalance already. They already get the majority of the publicity, and you're already seeing on top of it, to take one step further, you're already seeing the imbalance of the pay right now. Now you're seeing all the money being included at the top with the coaches and the athletic directors and whatnot. Why shouldn't that endorsement deal be spread apart and split in a fair share or fair revenue model with the athletes who are actually the ones producing and wearing the endorsement brand and the medium that they're showing on the court and whatnot and on the field? So it's an outrageous argument to say anything differently.
And speaking of endorsements, Zach, I read a story you had. Briefly, could you tell us about it, where you were stopped from entering an arena because you had the wrong water bottle?
Yeah, this, I can go talk all day on this one specific issue, but we're getting ready to play against Arizona in the Elite Eight game before we made it to the Final Four, and we're in a pregame shoot-around that morning. And I walk into the arena, and the security is going through our bags and checking everything. And they're, granted, there's not one fan at the open or at the practice. If they close practice, we're just going in to get our shooting round with our team. Long story short, as the security guard, you can't bring that water bottle in, he says to me. And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you can't bring in that water bottle. That's not a registered sponsor of the NCAA. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And he's like, okay, you can sit up, you can stand out here all you want. You're not practicing if you don't get rid of that water bottle, rip the label off, or give me the whole thing. I literally just laughed, and I made it as a joke and sent out a text or a tweet afterwards, and Jay Bills picked up on it, and a bunch of people just laughed and showed that such hypocrisy based on the NCAA standards that someone like me, who's getting stopped at the gate for not even being able to go into a close shoot-around because I didn't have the sponsored water bottle.
We'll leave it there for now, Zach. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thanks again for your time.
That was Zach Bohannon, captain of the 2014 UW-Madison men's basketball team. We've been talking about the issue of whether or not college athletes should be paid or be eligible to go out and get sponsorships. You can continue to weigh in on this debate over on Twitter. That's at CentralTimeWPR, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. By the way, you can reach us by either of those methods to give us any message, a story, idea, a comment on what we're talking about, you name it, Twitter or email. There was a musical milestone today with a Wisconsin connection. On this date in 1969, James Brown and his band recorded the song Funky Drummer, featuring the original Funky Drummer, Clyde Stubblefield. Clyde spent a lot of his life in Madison and did a lot of work with us at Wisconsin Public Radio. He passed away earlier this year. Clyde's drumming on that track is thought to be the most sampled piece of music ever. Here are some of the songs that it ended up in.
1989, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer. Music hit your heart, cause I know you got soul.
Boogie, jive, and rap is life where I'm from. Where I'm from, Ahmad play with Izzy where I'm from. Where I'm from, it be like run your coat black. Jupiter keeps a fat beat.
Yeah, yeah. Freedom. Freedom.
The drum track that keeps on giving Clyde Stubblefield the original funky drummer here on Central Time.